Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anna Mateo and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, a new study finds that students who plan attacks on schools are often bullied and act in ways that worry others. The same warning signs are found in many adults who carry out shooting attacks. The Secret Service National Threat Assessment Center carried out the study. It examined 100 students responsible for planning 67 attacks from 2006 to 2018 in schools across the U.S. Each of the planned attacks were discovered and prevented. Most of the students researched were angry at other students. Many were suicidal or had depression. 8 wanted to be famous. More than half of the students were impacted by bad childhood experiences. Many experienced drug dependence at home, or their parents had mental health problems. Others planned to kill themselves as part of the attack and used drugs and alcohol. The schools targeted were in 33 states. Most were public high schools. 37% were in areas near cities, and 14% were in cities. The plotters were mostly male. Only 5 were female. The youngest was 11, and the oldest was 19. Many of the students also showed interest in violence or hate. 1/3 researched past school shootings. 9 students displayed an interest in the leader of Nazi Germany, Adolf Hitler, Nazism, or white supremacy. The researchers found that about 94% talked about their plans in some way. 75% of plots were detected because the plotters talked about the attacks, either in person or online. About 36% were thwarted within just 2 days of their intended attacks. The findings demonstrate there are almost always intervention points available before a student resorts to violence, said Lena Olatheri, leader of the center. All of the plots studied were serious planned attacks, and the planners took at least some steps toward committing the attack. The people who discovered the plots and told officials likely saved lives. The report's findings will be given to more than 11,000 schools and community organizations for training, Olatheri said. The goal is to use the information so schools can better identify warning signs. But that does not mean expelling students. The study found expelling students doesn't eliminate the risk, said Stephen Driscoll, one of the writers of the study. Instead, schools should stop bullying and give mental health support. Some of the students were arrested and faced criminal charges. But the goal of the study, researchers said, was not to identify people to arrest, but to identify early warning signs so that students do not end up getting arrested. Driscoll said that planned violence, like school shootings, is preventable if communities can identify warning signs and intervene. The primary objective is providing a student with help as early as possible, Driscoll said.
Much of Italy is still in a coronavirus lockdown. So live music, theatrical performances, and movies continue to be banned. And many sporting activities are limited. However, in an industrial area just outside of Rome, competitive ballroom dancing is alive and well. With certain health and safety measures, it just looks a little different. Face coverings or social distancing are usually not part of the ballroom dancing experience. But they are now, and they do not stop partners of every age from dancing gracefully across the floor. At the new Dancing Days Center, dance partners are getting ready for the Italian Championship in Rimini in July. The government considers this activity a national interest, so the dancers are permitted to keep training. In Italy, other federally recognized competitive athletes are able to keep training, even during the latest virus-related bans. Yes, we can do it. Here we can keep on dancing, said Raffaella Serafini. At the age of 45, Serafini has competed in ballroom dancing for a long time, 35 years. She is the owner of New Dancing Days. The dance center has mirrors on the walls and multicolored lights. Partners wear face coverings during warm-ups and breaks. They can remove them while performing traditional ballroom or Latin dances. But most dancers keep them on anyway. It's something beautiful for us because we are older, but we can still put ourselves in play, said 70-year-old Franco Cali. He is training with his 74-year-old partner, for a competition at the end of April. Cali said he felt safe with the health measures taken by the dance center. Other dancers, he said, follow the measures seriously and obey them. The Italian Dance Sport Federation has ruled that 34 dancers are permitted to train in a place the size of New Dancing Days. Currently, all 34 dancers at the center, aged 9 to 76, train up to 5 days a week. From a viewing area above the dance floor, Serafini observes her dancers and shouts directions to them. If she sees something wrong, she will stop the music, go down to the dance floor, and show the correct way to do a step, pose, or turn. The school is my great pride, she said. When I see them on the dance floor, it is like I am there. I'm Anna Matteo.
The U.S. Space Agency's explorer, Perseverance, arrived on Mars on February 18th with an important piece of equipment. NASA's Perseverance was carrying an experimental aircraft called Ingenuity, which is set to have its first test flight this week. NASA hopes to make the helicopter the first vehicle to fly on a planet other than Earth. NASA recently announced that Ingenuity had been safely lowered onto the surface of Mars from its storage space underneath Perseverance. The Explorer, or rover, then moved about 5 meters away from Ingenuity. The rover and aircraft are communicating through radios. After separating from the rover, the helicopter faced its first important test on Mars, protecting itself from the planet's freezing temperatures. Readings taken from instruments on Perseverance from early April showed low temperatures at the landing area, called Jezero Crater, had reached minus 83 degrees Celsius. In a statement, NASA said Ingenuity passed the test by surviving its first night alone in the extreme cold. The helicopter used its own solar-powered battery to operate a heater to protect its electrical equipment from damage. The space agency praised the success as a major milestone for the experimental aircraft. Mimi Ong is Ingenuity's project leader at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. She said that while her team did all it could to prepare the helicopter, the group was very excited to see the results of their work on Mars. "We now have confirmation that we have the right insulation, the right heaters, and enough energy in its battery to survive the cold night, which is a big win for the team," Ong said. "We're excited to continue to prepare Ingenuity for its first flight test." The next set of tests involves the aircraft's motors and rotor equipment. The helicopter will be the first aircraft to attempt powered, controlled flight on another planet. NASA has compared Ingenuity's attempt to the Wright brothers' first flight of a motor-driven airplane near Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, in 1903. In recognition of that historic flight, a small piece of cloth that covered a wing from the Wright brothers' plane was attached to the helicopter for its first flight on Mars. The main purpose of the Perseverance rover is to search for signs of microbial life from the planet's ancient past. The Explorer is expected to collect rock and soil materials from the surface. They will be sent to Earth by a future mission to Mars. During its first test, Ingenuity will attempt to rise about 3 meters off the surface. It will try to briefly push forward into the planet's extremely thin atmosphere. Then the aircraft will attempt to turn around and complete a soft landing. If the first flight is successful, other tests will be carried out, with Ingenuity trying to go a little higher and farther each time. NASA says such helicopters could assist astronauts on future search and collection missions. NASA recently released pictures of Perseverance and Ingenuity. The space agency described one of the pictures as a selfie. It showed the rover and helicopter sitting on the rocky surface of Mars. The rover was able to capture the selfie with its robotic arm, which has a camera attached to the end. NASA said the picture was made from 62 individual images that were put together once they were sent back to Earth. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember.
The presidential race looks jar-lid tight. We could be in for a long night as voters decide whether Vice President Al Gore or Texas Governor George Bush will be the next president of the United States. It is that close.
In 2000, Americans were preparing to elect a new president in November. The United States Constitution limits presidents to two terms. Bill Clinton would be leaving office, so his Democratic Party needed to choose a new candidate. The Democrats nominated Clinton's vice president, Al Gore. Gore chose Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut as his running mate. Lieberman became the first Jewish candidate ever nominated by a major party to such a high office. He was first elected to the Senate in 1988. Al Gore was born in Washington in 1948. He was named after his father, a United States Senator from Tennessee. The future vice president grew up in Washington and in Carthage, Tennessee, where his family had a farm. He studied government at Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and graduated in 1969. That was during the Vietnam War. His father opposed American involvement in that war. But the young Al Gore joined the Army and spent about 6 months of his service as a military journalist in Vietnam. Back in civilian life, Gore again worked as a reporter. Later, he studied religion and then law at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. But he dropped out of law school to enter politics. He was elected to the United States House of Representatives in 1976. He became known for supporting nuclear arms control and protecting the environment. Al Gore was elected to the Senate in 1984. He was re-elected 6 years later. That was after he had tried to become the Democratic candidate for president in 1988. Then, in 1992, Bill Clinton won the party's nomination and asked Al Gore to be his vice president. As vice president, Gore became known for his work on issues involving the environment, technology, and foreign relations. In March 1999, he gave an interview on CNN. During that interview, he talked about his plans to enter the race for the presidential nomination the following year. He made the statement that during his service in Congress,
I took the initiative in creating the Internet.
He went on to say that he took the initiative in moving forward other efforts important to the economy, environmental protection, and educational improvements. But his comment about the Internet led to jokes and criticism that he was claiming to have actually invented it. The Republicans nominated Texas Governor George W. Bush as their presidential candidate. For his running mate, he chose Dick Cheney, a former Secretary of Defense. George Walker Bush was born in Texas in 1946, the oldest child of former President George Herbert Walker Bush. He grew up in the Texas cities of Midland and Houston. He graduated from Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut, and earned a master's in business administration at Harvard University. During the Vietnam War years, he was a pilot in the Texas Air National Guard. Later, he worked in the state's oil and gas industry. In 1988, Bush worked on his father's winning campaign for president. Later, he became one of the owners of the Texas Rangers, a Major League Baseball team. In 1994, George W. Bush was elected governor of Texas. He was re-elected 4 years later. Several other candidates also ran for president in the November 2000 election. These minor, or so-called third-party candidates, included activist Ralph Nader. He represented the Green Party. He criticized large corporations for having too much influence in America. Pat Buchanan, a conservative, ran as the Reform Party candidate. Public opinion surveys showed that the race between George Bush and Al Gore would be extremely close. The election took place on November 7th. More than 100 million people voted for them. Al Gore received about 540,000 more of those votes than George Bush did. But winning the popular vote does not make someone president. Americans do not directly elect their president. When they vote for a candidate, what they are really doing is voting for electors. The number of electors for each state is based on the size of its congressional delegation, which is based on population. These electors then vote in December in a system known as the Electoral College. The Electoral College officially elects the president. In the 2000 election, there were 538 electors in the Electoral College. To become president, the winner needed a simple majority of 270. Al Gore won the popular vote, but neither he nor George Bush won a majority of the electoral votes. Not that any of this was clear on election night.
Bulletin, Florida pulled back into the undecided column. This thing is so wild, wacky, and woolly, nobody knows how it's going
to
come out.
CNN right now is moving Florida to the too close to call column.
Too close to call.
Florida is now too close to call. I want to say that again. It's a confusing situation. Now, if you're disgusted with us, frankly, I don't blame you.
Florida is a big southern state. It had enough electoral votes to make either candidate the winner. Election officials counted almost 6 million votes on election night. George Bush had slightly more votes than Al Gore, but not enough to avoid a recount. Florida state law calls for a recount when the difference between two candidates is less than 0.5% of the votes. State recounts normally involve the governor, but the governor of Florida said he would not get involved. That was because the governor was Jeb Bush, George Bush's brother, and there were other issues with the election. Some black voters said election workers had unjustly prevented them from voting. There were also problems with voting machines and ballots. In one area, some Gore supporters believed they had voted for Pat Buchanan by mistake. The names were next to one another on the ballot.
Democrats said the ballot design was illegal. Republicans said Democratic Party officials had never objected to it. The disputed election results in Florida introduced a new term into popular speech. Americans began talking about chads. Whether it was hanging chads, pregnant chads, or dimpled chads, it amounted to the same problem. It meant that a voting machine had not cleanly punched out a bit of paper called a chad when the voter made a choice. As a result, the ballot would confuse a vote-counting machine and make the choice unreadable. That, in turn, meant election workers had to look at each questionable ballot and try to decide the voter's choice. All this took place with the nation and the world watching and wondering who would become America's next president. Something else only added to anger and debate over the situation in Florida. Florida's Secretary of State, its chief election officer, Catherine Harris, also happened to be a leader of the Bush campaign there.
Governor George W. Bush, 2,912,790.
Almost 3 weeks after the election, Florida officials declared George Bush the winner of the state's 25 electoral votes. That gave him a total of 271. Out of 6 million ballots, state officials said he had defeated Al Gore by 537 votes. But the election was still not over. Gore and his supporters in Florida asked the courts to reject the results because of what they said were the many voting problems. The Florida Supreme Court ordered another count of the disputed ballots. Bush campaign officials quickly appealed to the United States Supreme Court. The court said Florida law did not explain how officials should judge the ballots. The court found the situation in Florida unconstitutional because there were different standards around the state. The justices also said not enough time remained to settle the issue before the Electoral College had to meet. On December 12th, the court voted 7-2 to end the recount and 5-4 against ordering a new one. 6 days later, on December 18th, members of the Electoral College met in each state capital and the District of Columbia. They made the election official. George W. Bush would become the 43rd President of the United States.
I, George Walker Bush, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
He took office on January 20th, 2001. The election dispute had divided Americans. But less than a year later, the nation was brought together by events that would set the direction for the presidency of George W. Bush.
A plane has just crashed into the World Trade Center here in New York City. It happened just a few moments ago.
The United States suffered the worst terrorist attacks in its history on September 11th, 2001, a day that would be remembered as 9/11.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.